doesn't. The smaller one. Oh, okay. Well, I don't know if anyone. Do we really need this? Testing? 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 Doesn't work. I don't. My name is Roger Benjamin.
Thank you for that introduction and for your welcome. I was puzzled for a time as to what to speak about on this occasion, and then I thought that Hal Chase was always very much interested in conviction and convictions and the basis of conviction in politics and in other realms, so that I decided to make a brief statement about how I came to my convictions in terms of experiences. I've had a good many students who have asked me questions of that kind, and so for just a few moments I'd like to share a few thoughts along that line. They will necessarily be inadequate, obviously. And I call my remarks a standpoint. In the belief that each of us has to have a standpoint from which he or she looks at the world. You cannot stand no place. You must stand someplace. And this is particularly true, of course, of human beings. The angels, as far as I know, do not need to formulate a standpoint. It's given for them. They know exactly how to do their harps. The beasts, on the other hand, are guided more or less directly by factors outside themselves. It's only human beings, in a sense, who have to reflect on their experiences and to take a position, to define a goal, to attempt to become autonomous or self-governing, because they're constantly being pulled back to a denial of this task and have to emerge once more in the quest for autonomy. And as I shall suggest, this process is duplicated in the community. Our own experiences as human beings seeking to become free has a parallel, or have a parallel, in the community, which seeks to emerge from traditional sacred societies to political communities in which debate and discussion become the basis of order. I'd like to say a word, first of all, about my particular background, because I think that often interests students, and then suggest three poles around which I tend to think in terms of convictions. I think all of us must reflect at times on how our outlooks have been shaped and conditioned by early experiences. Psychoanalysis and such groups as the Jesuits have taught us that childhood experience is very vital in helping us understand a man or a woman. I should agree with them, but also emphasize that while our childhood experiences, and particularly our relations to our parents, help build the frameworks within which we initially think, each of us also has the capacity to transcend those frameworks and to construct frameworks which can legitimately be called personal, do not belong to anyone else. We are not merely the sum total of all our antecedents, in other words. Human personality, potentially, is also a creative whole, W-H-O-L-E, that can shape its parts. I grew up in Missouri and Oklahoma in a physician's household, and among the factors which I most deeply influenced my subsequent development and outlook were my early religious experience, my parents' beliefs and values, and my social and educational environment. Religion in my early experience was highly emotional, traveling preachers, for example, and healers, and The perspective I obtained upon religious experience was quite different from that which I subsequently attained. My parents' beliefs and values, I'm sure, played an important role in the working out of my own outlook. My father, although born into a religious family, had many agnostic elements in his makeup. He tried very much to be honest with himself and took great pride in the family motto on our coat of arms, Esse Quam Videri. And he took delight in giving me the translation, to be rather than to seem to be. A Republican in politics, my grandfather had been one of the founders of the Republican Party in Southern Illinois. He was frequently highly critical of particular personalities in politics. Thus, although he was a veteran of World War I, he resigned from the American Legion in high dudgeon one day and never rejoined till the end of his life. My mother was a much more highly disciplined person, and I think from her I obtained a strong streak of puritanical outlook. And I don't object to this. I think the Puritans, in many respects, have been sold down the river by their critics. And I would like to put in a word for them. Of course, my neurotic tendencies also perhaps are due to my Puritanism. My early social and educational environment undoubtedly had an important effect on what I was later led to believe. An early memory of mine was the ringing of the bells and the blowing of the whistles, which signaled the signing of the armistice, bringing an end to World War I. A little later, when I was in the fourth or fifth grade, I believe, I was reading in the history book about the Battle of New Orleans. The book pointed out rather glowingly that while the British had lost a great number of men, the Americans, presumably under the good generalship of Andrew Jackson, had lost only a few. What a wonderful victory. I remember being very puzzled and amazed that any book could praise a so-called victory which was won by taking human life. And this left a deep impression on me. But of course, you can always ask the question, why did it leave a deep impression on you? Wasn't there something there to start with? And where did that something come from? Later on in high school and college, I was to encounter the segregation laws of Oklahoma. They completely separated the races in school and provided that while white teachers could not teach blacks and blacks could not instruct whites, how, I asked myself, could this be reconciled with what I took to be the values of religion? Yet for some reason, I found very few students asking questions of this kind, and my college history teacher strenuously defended the segregation laws. As history goes, this is only relatively recently. And when we somehow sometimes doubt the possibility of progress, I think we can say that there has been enormous progress in terms of the problem of racism since those days. It was also a period when at Princeton University, a little later, many undergraduates cynically organized veterans of future wars and began demanding pensions while they could yet enjoy them. For the future wars, they said, they would be killed. In the future wars, they would be killed and wounded. Seemed to me a perfectly reasonable request. Much of my adolescence was experienced during the Great Depression. While my father was very much devoted to the so-called free enterprise system, and although I classified myself as a Republican until immediately before I was graduated from college, shortly after my graduation, I moved very rapidly in a socialist direction. I was eligible to vote for the first time when Franklin Roosevelt was running for his second term. I could not support Roosevelt, for he seemed to me to be taking us into war with his big army and navy program and his acceptance of all the militaristic cliches which have characterized American politics ever since, and which are now being exacerbated by a great admirer of Franklin Roosevelt in the White House. Moreover, it appeared to me that he was doing little that was fundamental in remolding an economic system under which there were at least 15 million unemployed, and there were still 9 million when the war came, when the war economy came. So I cast my first ballot for the late Norman Thomas. While I was not yet formally a member of the Socialist Party, I was moving rapidly in that direction. Since that day, I have supported only one major party candidate for the presidency. Guess who that was? I should mention one other facet of my early development which would play an important role in the evolution of my outlook. When I was about a sophomore in high school and was reading a wide variety of books, I was browsing through the public library one day and came across a volume by the late Sir Oliver Lodge, a Nobel Prize winner in physics, called Raymond. It was an account of his alleged communication with his dead son, who had lost his life in World War I. I was so fascinated and impressed that thereafter I began to build up a library on psychical phenomena, and my interest has not declined to this day. By the time I was 1 or 2 years out of college, the vague outlines of my tentative outlook had emerged. Since that time, I should say I've been working on the implications of the outlook, but am constantly re-examining it. For I've been impressed since my high school days by Socrates' proposition that the unexamined life is not worth living. If you ask me now where I stand on the major issues of life and death, and we can't come to grips with life unless we grapple with death, I would say that they might be divided into convictions about personhood, convictions about politics, and convictions about ultimates, or religion. First of all, personhood. One of my central experiences is that the self I am now is not the self I ought to be, although I must build on what I am now. We go through life seeking to discover what we ought to be and never completely finding it. But this quest is basic to the achievement of human personhood. The psyche and body are intimately interrelated, the latter limiting the former in what it can do, and the former having the capacity to shape the latter to its ends, at least in a measure. We come into this world, as Wordsworth said, trailing clouds of glory. Each of us has at one time lived either in the spiritual body alone or in a combination of spiritual and physical bodies. Our experiences in this life can be used to enhance our sensitivity to the universe and ourselves, or contrarywise, they can be employed to desensitize us and make us less aware. The main purpose of life is contemplation of nature, contemplation of ourselves, and contemplation of others as ends in themselves. In our personal encounters with others, we help discover ourselves while at the same time assisting others to find themselves. The highest level of this personal encounter is what we usually term friendship, and it becomes the basis, as Aristotle suggested, for the community, where friendships are less rich, where they're only watery, the basis for community is destroyed. And perhaps this is one of the things that's wrong with the contemporary world. Perhaps the most dramatic and most intimate form of personal encounter is the sexual relationship. While sexual experience is perceived immediately as physical attraction, the physical attraction is merely a kind of sign of something beyond it. And even the physical pleasure can be appreciated more if it is tied to mental and spiritual affinity. Because human personhood is so many-sided and deep, full sexual fulfillment is for perhaps most individuals best discovered in a lifetime relationship. Yet human beings vary so widely that it seems to me that an ideal society will envision many forms of the sexual relationship, the equivalent of polygyny, polyandry, group marriage, as well as monogamy. This becomes one of the important themes, it seems to me, if one is to study seriously the problem of human personality. Equally, however, the experience of sex can lead us to, under some circumstances, to experience new dimensions of the evil, the false, and the unaesthetic. This is not untypical of life as a whole. The most characteristically human experiences may move either in the direction of an affirmation of values or in a denial of them. Indeed, there is a sense in which one cannot fully appreciate the good, the true, and the beautiful, unless one has at least a nodding experience with their reverse. I think it was St. Thomas Aquinas who once suggested that we ought to at least shake hands with the devil, or words to this effect, in order to know what he was about. I became more impressed by the potentialities of human personality the longer I live. In those who are seemingly most articulate and insensitive, one will often find the possibilities for love, great creation, and enormous power. At the same time, often those who are most intelligent and best educated, in a formal sense, will, through pride in their alleged superiority, sometimes commit the most monumental of blunders and rationalize the most cruel of deceptions. As in the intellectuals, the best and the brightest, as they have been called, who planned and executed the war in Vietnam. Part of the mystery of human personality, of course, lies in its capacity to be transformed. The sinner can be converted into the saint. It has happened. Now, the experiences of a good liberal education can literally liberate us from fear, from prejudice, and from blind obedience to custom or rulers. I have great confidence in genuine liberal education and very much deplore the contemporary tendency to question its value. We need more, not less, liberal education, the kind of education which subjects all institutions and beliefs to careful scrutiny. If we are ever to grapple successfully with the enormous political problems which confront us in the coming generation, liberal education must continue throughout life. It must be the kind of education which not only passes on a tradition, but also encourages men and women to criticize the tradition. We ought not to expect from life any full achievement of our goals for ourselves, yet this should not mean that we ought not to have goals. I cannot understand the viewpoint which seems to depreciate goal-oriented persons. To be sure, we must be constantly aware that in the achievement of personal goals, we must be careful not to inhibit the attainment of the goals of others, for we are indeed members of one another. But to discover goals for ourselves is in itself a worthwhile task, one should which recognizes our imperfections as we are and which seeks perfections as what we should be. We live at the juncture of time and the timeless, and this both limits us in what we can achieve and should remind us that our worst frustrations are not final. If a purpose of life is the discovery of ourselves, of others, and of nature, then the ancient caution that we should not regard as central the mere accumulation of material things takes on a new meaning. Although in my own life I'm always failing in this respect, I know that I should limit my material wants, both for my own sake and for the sake of others. A culture which exalts simply spending and consumption is undermining itself. This is my own puritanical strain. Because of the structure of the economic order, my income is high, I should give a substantial part away for civil, social, educational, and other purposes. Indeed, if someone, through no fault of his own, is wanting and I have more than I need, St. Thomas Aquinas argues, and I should agree with him, that the person who is in need, if I do not share, legitimately can seize what he needs of mine for his own use. This is a principle which I suppose surprises many of you who are not familiar, for example, with the moral theory of the medieval saint. The ultimate frustration for each of us is death, whatever our beliefs may be in the survival of the human personality after death. The physical body does die. We do decay, and all earthly life, relatively speaking, is but a momentary flash. Awareness of the reality of death and courage to face it honestly are indispensable if we are to understand life. If we did not fear death, as the Polish philosopher Wincenty Lutosławski argues, we might be more courageous in standing up to social evils and tyranny. It is our fear of death that often keeps us from being outspoken and allows the tyrant to rule. When we forget that we are mortal physically, we tend to emphasize things that in the ultimate scale of values, at least as I see them, are unimportant: prestige and glory and attachment to material things. Although it is extremely difficult to do, each of us ought to live as if he or she will die tomorrow. Some of the most important discoveries in the future, perhaps, await us in the field of psychical phenomena. The dimensions of human personality in such phenomena as telepathy, clairvoyance, out-of-the-body experiences, psychokinesis, and communication with the so-called dead are far more significant, in my judgment, than the nature of the rocks on the moon or the precise composition of the polar caps on Mars, as important as those are. Yet we will spend billions on space exploration and almost nothing on psychical and similar research. I come now to the second pole around which this paper is built, that is politics. The achievement of what each of us should be as a person is intimately tied up with politics. In religious terms, no one of us can be completely saved unless others too are on the road to salvation. As William Blake, one of my favorite poets, once put it, "The starving dog at his master's gate bespeaks the ruin of the state." So closely are we tied to one another, particularly in a complex civilization, that issues of politics, that is, of justice and definition of freedom, demarcations of power, direction of the economy, problems of war and peace, ought also to become personal problems for each of us. Each ought to discover where he or she stands in the political scheme of things and how he or she can best contribute to the tasks of political, that is, of deliberate conscious ordering of human collective affairs. The overwhelming political challenge today is that of deliberately creating a world order, embodying diversity in unity and unity in diversity. Both poles must necessarily be recognized. In these tasks, it is indispensable that full freedom of oral and written expression be not only recognized but also encouraged. And I'm disturbed by certain tendencies in the contemporary administration in that respect, because I suspect that we're in for a day of increasing repression unless we resist it. For my own part, as I suggested earlier, I am a democratic, decentralist, socialist, and sometimes I add anarchist. By this I mean that I have no confidence in the so-called free enterprise system that obtains in the United States. Neither do I have confidence in the despotic state capitalist system of the Soviet Union. While time does not allow me to defend my beliefs in detail, they would include the notion of a planned economy for democratic ends, difficult as that is, in which the major instruments of production, including land, and distribution and exchange, are owned socially although not necessarily governmentally. The idea of a vast expansion of so-called free goods and services, in which we would have not only free parks and playgrounds and schools, but also free medical service, legal service, and possibly even free bread. By free, of course, I do not mean there would be no cost, but rather that one would not personally pay for what one used, any more than one today pays fees for the use of the public parks, usually. I think it's an outrage, for example, that in the distribution of medical care in the United States, a very ill person is often confronted by a bill for a heavy medical bill at the very time he or she is trying to recuperate from an illness. This, if anything, would exacerbate, it seems to me, the illness. And I'd like to see the medical societies carry on a crusade for a rational system of the distribution of medical care in this country. It's about 100 years overdue. And now a word about my pacifism. It is grounded in religious, ethical, and practical consideration. My religious convictions tell me that human life is to be respected, that we ought not to kill human beings deliberately. My ethical experience moves in the same direction. My study of history and politics leads me to believe that all war has been impractical in the sense that it can never contribute overall to the kind of political world that I think desirable. I was a conscientious objector in World War II, an early opponent of the war in Vietnam, one of the stupidest as well as the most immoral wars in history, and I shall oppose every future war, no matter what its alleged objective, even if it is the rescue of 750,000 sheep in the Falkland Islands. One of the highest obligations we can have today, in my judgment, is to refuse to enter the military forces of any country to help erode militarist ideology, which has been growing in the United States since World War II, and particularly in the last 2 years, and to attack the notion that military so-called defense can defend anything valuable. That's an illusion, in my judgment. And I'm interested in noting that the late military historian Walter Millis, in one of his last essays, calls the essay "The Uselessness of Military Power." This is by Walter Millis, not by a nut like myself. Pacifism does not imply a refusal to resist evil, but rather an insistence that evil must not be opposed by methods which only compound the evil. And that could be expanded, of course, almost indefinitely. In general, I should stress the importance politically of an individual's readiness to disobey for conscientious reasons. Obedience in our society tends to become too habitual, too unreflective. Ultimately, the only way to check tyranny, and most of mankind today lives under at least semi-tyrannical and despotical regimes, the only way to check tyranny is through mass refusal to obey the tyrant. You're seeing some very good examples in Poland. The end result of the Polish situation is not yet in. Don't get discouraged about it. There are no tyrants, as one 19th century writer put it. There are only slaves, and that I believe. And I see in myself the very slavish tendencies that lead to the creation of tyranny. It may be that utopia will never be attained, but each of us has an obligation in his or her own way to attempt to achieve it. And now a concluding word about the third point, that is ultimates. Emily Post was once asked, what should one converse about in polite society? She replied by suggesting that one should never discuss religion or politics, for they were too controversial. My response would be to ask, what else is there to talk about? While this is an exaggeration, obviously, one immediately thinks of questions involving art and music and education and sex and science and so on. Still, it seems to me that religion and politics are very fundamental in any world outlook. And as Gandhi used to say, they cannot be sharply separated from one another. This creates one of the great political as well as constitutional problems. As I've indicated earlier, my religious views were undoubtedly affected by my family experience and adolescent development. They are still in process of development. But I should say that in general, I have moved away from formal fixed professions of faith to a much greater reliance on constantly renewing religious experiences gained through meditation and reflection. Formal professions of faith tend to become frozen, unfortunately, and we frequently idolize the words or the formula, but not the reality. Religious experience is more nearly a process of seeking and hoping to find, opening a way for the ultimate to break in on one and to help one integrate one's life. Integration is related to wholeness, which is related to what might be called spiritual health. Since my early days, I've never understood how one could be an atheist in any literal sense of that term. For it has seemed to me that to deny the existence of God, or the gods, implies far more knowledge on my part than I could possibly have. I can understand an agnostic position. I don't know, but I don't know anything anyway, so I could easily admit that. But to assert flatly that there is no supreme being, for example, if that's what it means to be an atheist, I would find beyond my competence to make any such statement. In the end, the most impressive thing about my religious experience is the sense of mystery, it seems to me, at the heart of it. As a convert to Quakerism, which emphasizes religious experience rather than forms of words, I get more and more impressed by this, that religious experience involves a sense of mystery at the heart, virtually, of everything. And the mystery grows the more one reflects on one's religious experience. I would say religious experience is very closely akin to aesthetic experience. To the extent that I have grown in knowledge and wisdom, and I sometimes doubt whether I have at all, the mystery grows and deepens. At the heart of my own religious experience is a feeling of awe about everything. That is, it seems to me, for example, if you look at the story of modern physics, which has so far gone beyond the sort of mechanistic model that we were familiar with in the 19th and early 20th centuries, this is especially true, that the world seems to be suffused with mystery. The mystery grows and deepens. At the heart of my own religious experience is a feeling of awe about everything, not merely about the Supreme Being, but also about all being and all existence, and even about the magnitude of both good and evil. There's a kind of awe about the power of evil, sort of like the doctor motioning to his colleague to come and look at this beautiful case of cancer. You know, one feels full of awe at the enormous power of evil, but equally so at the enormous power capacity for good in human beings. They coexist. It's hardly necessary to add that this sense of awe is central as we reflect on personhood, the political challenge of building a world order, and the human religious quest in seeking the ground of all being and ultimate concern. Thank you. Well, that's the ethical side. I think religious experience is more than ethics, of course.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yes, quite often. I've always paid them with a letter of protest. I don't find that satisfactory. But neither do I find the position of one of my friends, who's a bookseller, satisfactory, who withholds each tax period, and then the Internal Revenue Service has a kind of nodding agreement with him. It comes and attaches his bank account plus interest plus penalty. I don't find that satisfactory either. I'm looking for an answer. And the closest I can come would be if we could have a concerted mass refusal, which would have political effect, that this could be a legitimate method and an effective method, perhaps, of calling a halt to what's going on. Well, I suppose I don't know of anyone who isn't a believer in something. So that's the way I would answer. I'm a non-believer in many things. I'm a non-believer in human sacrifice, for example. So I would simply pin down such a question and ask. Well, I think every set of beliefs is mixed, and I doubt whether you can make a flat statement about the content of Judeo-Christian beliefs, because there are many cross currents and eddies within those themselves. You'd have to say, well, I don't believe specifically what you believe, and then give the reasons. Frank? Well, you can answer those questions better than I can, Frank, but you've asked good questions. No, I don't. Obviously, I don't think the human being is only a physical being. And I think that the modern physicist's view of the universe, of course, is constantly shifting. And any notion that you can confine it to the temporal, for example, to time, our space, I think, has to be questioned.
Yes, behind and then here. Recently, some people, I think Jonathan Schell, have suggested that if you can't eliminate nuclear arms, perhaps you should try to eliminate the nation state. How do you feel through history that the nation state has contributed or
It's been a double-edged sword, the nation-state, as so many things are. On the one hand, it's provided a sense of community, a kind of sense of community, with the breakdown of other forms of community. On the other hand, it's been a militant engine of destruction in the world. And it seems to me that we have to question it increasingly, but the only way we can question it is to build up new forms of community, which we will no longer be dependent upon the kind of distorted community sense that it seems to me is embodied in the nation state.
Do you have any suggestions for communities and educational systems at many levels against the considerable fanaticism that they are wrapped by periodically?
The fanaticism of what?
Let's say the single-issue people
Oh.
Attack political educational systems for trying to be broader than their narrow range?
The best suggestion I would have is that you have to emphasize that every set of beliefs has to be seen in a context of some sort, and that you can't isolate it completely. As a pacifist, I'm subject legitimately to the charge, I think, that sometimes I try to isolate the pacifist issue and don't see its relationship to other issues. So I think it's a constant caution that has to be offered. I think the same is true on both sides of the abortion issue, for example. You get the same tendency there. Yeah, that's what we've said through history, yes. It's a necessary evil, and I don't believe it. It's one of those issues that it's very, very difficult to prove. That is your position, to demonstrate. You can offer considerations. Yeah, I think that the best hope for Nicaragua and Afghanistan and other countries that are being exploited, including perhaps some parts of the United States, is the kind of technique that Gandhi tried to develop and Martin Luther King. And we're just on the verge, really, of new insights, it seems to me, in that method of struggle or method of conflict. And I think it holds out enormous possibilities, as Gene Sharp points out, for example, in his book, The Politics of Nonviolent Action.
Thank you very much.